Chapter 2. Examining the Evidence. It was evening before we reached the little town of Tavistock, which lies in the middle of the huge circle of Dartmoor. Two gentlemen were awaiting us in the station. One was a tall, fair man with lion-like hair and beard, and curiously intense light blue eyes. The other was a small, alert person, very neat and well-dressed in a fine suit with an eyeglass. The latter was Colonel Ross, who is famous in racing circles. The other was Inspector Gregory, a man who is rapidly making his name in the English Detective Service.
"I am delighted that you have come down, Mr. Holmes," said the Colonel.
"Have there been any fresh developments?" asked Holmes.
"We have made very little progress," said the inspector. "We have an open carriage outside. As you would no doubt like to see the place before the light fails, we might talk it over as we drive."
Riding through the charming old Devonshire city, Inspector Gregory poured out a stream of remarks on the case. Holmes listened and threw in an occasional question or remark. Colonel Ross simply leaned back with his arms folded and his hat down over his eyes. Gregory was formulating his theory, which was almost exactly what Holmes had guessed in the train.
"The net is drawn pretty close around Fitzroy Simpson," he remarked. "I believe that he is our man. The evidence against him is certainly very strong. He had a great interest in the disappearance of the favorite. He lies under suspicion of having poisoned the stable boy. He was undoubtedly out in the storm. He carried a heavy stick, and his scarf was found in the dead man's hand. I really think we have enough to go to court."
Holmes shook his head. "A clever counsel would tear it all to pieces," he said. "Why should he take the horse out of the stable? If he wished to injure it, why could he not do it there? Has a copy of the stable key been found in his possession? What chemist sold him the powdered opium? Above all, where could he, a stranger to the district, hide a horse, and such a horse as this?"
"Some of these difficulties are not so hard to explain as they seem. He is, in fact, not a stranger to the district. He has twice lodged at Tavistock in the summer. The opium was probably brought from London. The key, having served its purpose, would have been thrown away. The horse may be at the bottom of one of the pits or old mines on the moor."
"What does he say about the scarf?"
"He says that it is his and declares that he had lost it. But a new element has been introduced into the case, which may account for his leading the horse from the stable."
Holmes showed a sudden interest at this.
"It appears that a party of gypsies camped on Monday night within a mile of the spot where the murder took place. On Tuesday, they were gone. Now, say that there was some understanding between Simpson and these gypsies. Might he not have been leading the horse to them when he was caught? May they not have it now?"
"It is certainly possible."
"The moor is being searched for these gypsies. I have also examined every stable and associated building in Tavistock for 10 miles in every direction."
"There is another training stable quite close, I understand."
"Yes, Mapleton Stables, and that is a factor which we must certainly not neglect. Desborough, their horse, was second in the betting for the coming race. They had an interest in the disappearance of the favorite. Silas Brown, the trainer, is known to have had large bets on the event, and he was no friend to poor Straker. We have, however, examined the stables, and there is nothing to connect him with the affair."
"And nothing to connect this man Simpson with Mapleton Stables?"
"Nothing at all."
Holmes leaned back in the carriage and the conversation ceased. A few minutes later, our driver pulled up at a neat little red brick house. Some distance off, across a field, lay another long, gray building. In every other direction, the open moor stretched away to the skyline. In the distance, we could see the pointed church roofs of Tavistock. Then, away to the west, a group of houses marked the Mapleton Stables. We all sprang out except for Holmes, who continued to lean back with his eyes fixed on the sky in front of him. He was entirely absorbed in his own thoughts.
It was only when I touched his arm that he came to himself with a violent start and stepped out of the carriage.
"Excuse me," he said, turning to Colonel Ross, who had looked at him in some surprise. "I was daydreaming." There was a sparkle in his eyes and evident excitement in his manner. I was convinced that his hand was on a clue, though I could not imagine where he had found it.
"Perhaps you would prefer to go at once to the scene of the crime, Mr. Holmes?" said Gregory.
"I think that I should prefer to stay here a little. Straker was brought back here, I presume?"
"Yes, he lies upstairs. The trial is tomorrow."
"He has been in your service some years, Colonel Ross."
"I have always found him an excellent servant."
"I presume that you made a list of what he had in his pockets at the time of his death, Inspector?"
"I have the things themselves in the sitting room if you would care to see them."
"I should be very glad." We all filed into the front room and sat around the central table. The inspector unlocked a square tin box and laid a small pile of things before us. There was a box of matches, 2 inches of a candle, a pipe, a small bag of long-cut tobacco, a silver watch with a gold chain, 5 gold coins, an aluminum pencil case, a few papers, and an ivory-handled knife with a very delicate, inflexible blade, marked Weiss & Company, London.
"This is a very interesting knife," said Holmes. "I presume, as I see bloodstains on it, that it is the one which was found in the dead man's hand. Watson, this knife is surely in your line."
"It is what we call a cataract knife," I said.
"I thought so. A very delicate blade devised for very delicate work. A strange thing for a man to carry with him on a rough expedition, and it certainly would not shut in his pocket."
"The tip was guarded by a disc of soft wood, which we found beside his body," said the inspector. "His wife tells us that the knife had lain on the dressing table. He had picked it up as he left the room. It was a poor weapon, but perhaps the best that he could lay his hands on at the moment."
"Very possible. How about these papers?"
"Three of them are hay dealers' accounts. One of them is a letter of instructions from Colonel Ross. This other is a designer's account for £37.15, made out by Madame Le Cerier of Bond Street to William Derbyshire. Mrs. Straker tells us that Derbyshire was a friend of her husband's. Occasionally, his letters were addressed here."
"Madame Derbyshire had somewhat expensive tastes," remarked Holmes. 22 guineas is rather heavy for a single dress. However, there appears to be nothing more to learn. We may now go down to the scene of the crime." As we left the sitting room, a woman met us and laid her hand on the inspector's sleeve. Her face was worried and thin and eager, stamped with the print of a recent horror.
"Have you got them? Have you found them?" she asked breathlessly.
"No, Mrs. Straker, but Mr. Holmes here has come from London to help us. We shall do all that is possible."
"Surely I met you in Plymouth at a garden party some little time ago, Mrs. Straker," said Holmes.
"No, sir, you are mistaken."
"I could have sworn to it. You wore a costume of dove-colored silk decorated with ostrich feathers."
"I never had such a dress, sir," answered the lady.
"Ah, that quite settles it," said Holmes. And with an apology, he followed the inspector outside. A short walk across the moor took us to the hollow in which the body had been found. At the edge of it was the bush on which the coat had been hung.
"There was no wind that night, I understand," said Holmes.
"None, but very heavy rain."
"In that case, the coat was not blown against the bush, but placed there."
"Yes, it was laid across the bush."
"I perceive that the ground has been walked on a good deal. No doubt many feet have been here since Monday night."
"A piece of matting has been laid here at the side, and we have all stood on that."
"Excellent."
"In this bag I have one of the boots which Straker wore.
I have also one of Fitzroy Simpson's shoes and a cast horseshoe of Silver Blaze.
My dear Inspector, these will be an incredible help.
Holmes took the bag. He then went down into the hollow. He pushed the matting into a more central position. Then, stretching himself on his front and leaning his chin on his hands, he made a careful study of the mud in front of him.
Hello, he said suddenly. What's this?
It was a match, half burned. The match was so coated with mud that it looked at first like a little chip of wood.
I cannot think how I missed it, said the inspector with annoyance.
It was invisible, buried in the mud. I only saw it because I was looking for it.
What? You expected to find it?
I thought it not unlikely. He took the boots from the bag and compared the impressions of each of them with marks on the ground. Then he climbed up to the top edge of the hollow. There he crawled about among the ferns and bushes.
I am afraid that there are no more tracks, said the inspector. I have examined the ground very carefully for 100 yards in each direction.
Indeed, said Holmes, rising. I should not bother to do it again after what you say, but I would like to take a little walk over the moor before it grows dark. I shall put this horseshoe into my pocket for luck.
Colonel Ross, who had shown some signs of impatience, glanced at his watch.
I wish you would come back with me, Inspector, said he. There are several points on which I should like your advice. And do we not owe it to the public to remove our horse from the cup race?
Certainly not, cried Holmes. I would let the name stand.
The colonel bowed.
I am very glad to have had your opinion, sir, he said. You will find us at poor Straker's house when you have finished your walk. We can drive together into Tavistock.